my name is Charlie Catlett. In the daytime, I work at Argonne National Laboratory just outside of Chicago and at the University of Chicago. I'm a senior computer scientist. I've been at Argonne for 25 years, and I've been working in the internet and high-performance computing, supercomputing space since 1985. I've been working in AI with my own research for the last 15 years or so. So I wanted to put this seminar together to do a couple of things. So one is to hopefully demystify the technology. And so we'll talk first about just the fundamentals of how, what do we mean when we say a machine is learning, when we say machine learning, or what do we mean by artificial when we say artificial intelligence. With that as sort of a background, I want to talk about some of the ways I use AI and that I see other people using AI in useful ways. And then I'll talk about some of the things to watch out for, some of the ways that we might over or underestimate AI's capabilities or possibly use it in ways that are less than the best ways. And then we'll wrap up at the end just sort of talking through various topics about how AI is affecting and will affect society and how we can think about it from a Christian point of view. I should also say I have three kids and three grandkids. That's why I say during the day I'm a computer scientist. The rest of the time, I'm my name is Pop. So throughout this, this is the third year in a row that I've done talks on AI here at ELF, and I found the first time I did this that it was very hard for me, even as somebody who works in the field, to find a good set of resources on the web that people could use to sort of come up to speed out of the million or more things that you could put together. And so from the beginning, I kept track of the things that I used as sources, and so you'll see the little number on the right-hand side at the bottom of many of my slides, and that will take you to, if you go to the QR code here, the link that takes you to, then you'll be able to not just see the source that I use, but I always include a link to it, so you could say, oh, you had this graph or what have you, and I want to look at the report that you pulled that graph from. You'll be able to do that by going to the bibliography, and I'll put that QR code up at the end, and of course, happy to give it to you otherwise. So I also have just kind of looked at information about how people are thinking about AI, because I'm immersed with a bunch of other AI people, and although I live with people who are not AI people and have friends that are not, one or two friends that are not AI people, we think about this area differently because we're so familiar with it. And in some ways that's good, in some ways that's not so good. This is just a survey that was done recently. On the left, the public is far more concerned about the increase in use of AI than AI experts are. So 51%, again, this is the U.S. I couldn't find global or European statistics, but it's probably representative. Half of the people in the U.S. are very more concerned than excited about AI. And half of AI experts are more excited than concerned. And I would say, if I don't know who the AI experts are, but I would say that the people I work with are probably equally concerned. So we're probably in the middle there, and that's so we're in line with the general public, at least the people that I work with. Then they surveyed a number of different topics here, things that people are concerned about. The big difference between the AI experts, which are the green numbers, and the U.S. General population is AI experts don't seem as concerned about AI leading to less connection between people. I would say I would be more concerned than my colleagues there. And AI experts are less concerned about job loss than the general population. And I would say I'm not as concerned as the general population, but I tend toward the middle on that one. And then more specifically about jobs, looking over the next 20 years, it's sort of mixed response there. The 64% of the U.S. public expects fewer jobs, whereas 40% of the AI experts expect that. I expect there to be fewer jobs, but I also expect there to be new kinds of jobs that that we didn't have before AI. So anyone knows that none of us have a crystal ball, but I'll get into some more details on this. But I just looked at this, and I just thought it was interesting that the experts are, in some cases, very far from what the general public is thinking. And I think that's instructive for those of us who are in the midst of doing AI to remember that. So as I mentioned, we're going to kind of break this into four different sections, and we'll probably get through most of the first and second before the coffee break, and then finish up with the others. So let's begin here. Artificial intelligence is not something that's new. It's been a topic of research for longer than any of us have been alive, or most of us, I guess, any of us have been alive since the 1930s or 40s. And it rests on top of work that's more than 100 years old from many of the leading mathematicians. There wasn't something called computer science back, in 1900, let's say. And then a group of this sort of middle group here, this group of linguists and mathematicians got together at Dartmouth University in the 1954, I think it was, for a summer workshop on artificial intelligence. And that kind of was what crystallized the idea of artificial intelligence being a field of scientific study. The three guys at the top are Turing Award winners from several years ago, two or three years ago. The Turing Award is the equivalent of a Nobel Prize for computer science. And these guys won the Turing Award for their contributions to computer science, and in particular, the underlying mechanism that we use for computer science. Almost every AI capability today is built on top of neural networks, artificial neural networks. And these guys pioneered the mechanisms for creating and training and using those neural networks. And what Jeff Hinton said in his, these guys always, then they win the Turing Award and then they embark on talking all around the world. And so a lot of them say it's named the Turing Award because after I won it, I have to take this tour and give talks around the world. But in Hinton's talk, he's talking about what really made AI explode in the last 5 years, and he attributes it to increases in computing power. And I think increases in data would also be a fair addition to that. And that's where my own work in high-performance computing kind of intersected with AI over the last 15 years or so. Because the way that we're doing this could not have been done before, and we'll talk more about that. You know, in 1930, a computer was a person. That's what they called these people that had their pads and pencils and adding machines. Conrad Zuse was one of the pioneers of computing in the 30s and 40s, and he's from Germany. There you see Conrad standing in front of the Z3, or maybe it's the Z2, his second or third machine that he built in about 1940. That's a picture of me in 1985. I was at the Supercomputer Center at the University of Illinois, and I thought it would be fun to get a picture of me doing a Vulcan mind meld with the computer. That's back when supercomputers looked really cool, which is, I have to admit, one of the reasons I got interested in supercomputers. They look like Star Trek furniture. And then you can see me in the upper left there back in 2022 on in between two of the rows of the supercomputer that we built at Argonne National Laboratory called Aurora. And you can then see Aurora is just basically a bunch of rows of refrigerators compared to the really cool-looking Cray supercomputer, the red one there. And then ChatGPT came out in late 2022 and sort of exposed AI. It brought with it some capabilities that some of us had only started to see see coming maybe 2 years before. In 2019 or so, we did a series of workshops around the U.S. with about 1,500 people involved from academia and industry and federal laboratories, and we were just looking at where is AI going, and we could begin to see the kind of initial capabilities of something like a ChatGPT, but it was very, very primitive. And none of us are used to something going from very primitive to very mature in the space of 2 years. And so ChatGPT and even things that have happened since then have, if you feel like it took you off guard because you weren't paying attention, you can feel better because the people that were paying attention were caught off guard as well. So I'm wearing an Apple Watch, and it is more powerful than the red supercomputer that I'm standing in front of right there. That computer cost $15 million, and it cost about $3 million to outfit the room and the building and put the electricity and cooling in. So nearly $20 million to create something that not only is less powerful than the Apple Watch, but had no display. So you can only talk to it to it with text. So this technology moves pretty quickly in the space of 40 years. A $15 million supercomputer is now something you can wear on your wrist. So I mentioned the Turing Award, which is named after this person here, Alan Turing, a mathematician. Mathematician, you wouldn't call him a computer scientist because there wasn't something called computer science back then, but he thought a lot about how machines might be able to compute. And he wrote this paper in 1950 called Computing Machinery and Intelligence and asked the question, can machines think? And this started, he proposes something that's now called the Turing test, which is a person is typing back and forth with something, either a computer or a person, and in the course of a 5-minute conversation, the person can't tell if it's a person or a computer that they're talking to, and if that is the case, then the computer, if it is a computer, wins the Turing Award, or the Turing wins the Turing test. And that is still something that we talk about today, the Turing test. And I would say probably we're now 20 years in to machines that could pass the Turing test and have gone way beyond the original test. But it's good to keep in mind, and I'll come back to this a little bit. In the early days of AI, it was board games that proved to be a good way to measure progress because board games have specific rules. And in the case of at least some games like Go on the right or checkers on the left, there's an outcome that's either win or lose. In chess, there can be draws, so that makes it a little more complicated. But these fixed rules make it easier for us to judge if a program is capable or not. And so the fact that in 1995 or so, IBM's computer beat Garry Kasparov at chess, well, that was an unambiguous result that told us progress about AI. That's a picture of me in front of another supercomputer called the Connection Machine 5, and that was about 1995 or so. And I can take no credit for the MIT Socrates winning the championship on one weekend, other than that my boss and I got a call from MIT a few weeks before they were going to have this tournament, and they said, can we take over your entire supercomputer for a weekend to play chess? And we thought this was a great idea. The chemists and physicists that weren't able to use the machine that weekend were a little bit upset with us, but we thought this was science, and so we would push it forward. So that's the reason I'm in front of that. Now, we have many ways to test AI systems, from language comprehension to language generation to even standard tests like the Mensa IQ test. And you can see these days, the hump in the middle is 100. IQ 100 means average intelligence across all people. So you can see we've got many models that are starting to push their way to the other side to be, in terms of this test, more capable intellectually than the average human being. So that's, of course, a narrow measurement of intelligence, but it is one. And as I mentioned, there are lots of ways to measure these, and things are moving very quickly. These are just showing, you don't need to read the individual lines, what they mean, but you can see I'm not allowed to go out of this box. So I'll just reach over. So I don't have a pointer either. So I'm just going to go this way. Ready? Okay. So reading comprehension tests, like four different tests, image recognition, complex reasoning, code generation, which means writing software, and 2015, 2020, 2023. So you could see that very quickly these models caught up to human capabilities in those areas. And that's one of the reasons why this ChatGPT has sort of caused everyone to go bonkers in the last few years, because it's just something that happened very quickly. 2 years ago, I remember telling something, well, somebody here, well, ChatGPT was, oh, thanks all. thank you. So ChatGPT was a big cannonball into the pool with a lot of splash, but we're probably not going to see a lot more of those for the next few years. And I would say, if I could go back, I would say, put your swimsuit on, because it's going to be a lot of change over the next couple of years. This is a graph on the right-hand side. So for those of you who are practiced in math, we use something called a logarithmic chart to plot things that are exponential, because otherwise it just goes like this. And that's an exponential chart, so that every one of those horizontal lines is 10 times the capability of the one below it. And what we see there on the curve where it says we are here is this increase in capability that's a combination of hardware and software and algorithms, techniques, that is on a pace of roughly 10 times as fast over a 12 or 18 month period of time, which is amazing and something we just can't really get our heads around. And you can see then it has this inflection point in about 2027 or so, where then it goes like super up like 10 times in 6 months. And that is, automated AI research. So we have this term called artificial superintelligence, which is not only faster at doing things that humans, but much smarter than humans. And we think that in the 2027, 2028, 2029 timeframe, we will get to the point where the AI system will be able to improve itself, which is a terrifying thought. And so that's why I say, you know, there are going to be more splashes over the next couple of years. So if you're not slightly queasy about this, then I would say you're not getting what's going on. But I don't think you should be afraid. And so by the end of today, hopefully your queasiness will give way to a sense of uneasiness, but trust in the God who created this and the people that create AI. So how should we respond? I mean, one way to respond is to be afraid and circle the wagons. We could fight. And I would say what we want to do and what I want to do with us together over the next hour and a half or 2 hours or how long we have is reason about AI so that we can understand what's happening and just kind of put a plan and act around it. So remember I mentioned the Turing test. So this person at the bottom is not able to see that they're maybe talking to a person or maybe they're talking to a computer. And over 5 minutes, if they can't tell the difference and it's the computer, then the computer has passed the Turing test. And I mentioned that's been done 20 years ago. So I want to just talk a little bit about what we mean by artificial when we talk about artificial intelligence. This is not a technology question. It's a linguistic and philosophy question. I'm not a philosopher, so I'll apologize ahead of time to the philosophers here if I oversimplify or get something wrong. So there are two ways that we use the word artificial. One way that we use it is to say it's something that's not really the thing, but it's a substitute for the thing. So a plastic plant serves some of the functions of a plant, but it's not really a plant. We haven't created with a plastic plant, we haven't created a new plant. A new plant species. With, you know, a fur coat, we haven't created a new kind of animal skin. We've just created something that looks like a fur coat. And we haven't really made our eyelashes longer. If we put fake eyelashes on, we just make ourselves look different. So that's the sense of artificial in the sense of an imitation of something that's not really that thing. And in that case, we're talking about AI as a very powerful tool. So there's another way that we use the word artificial, which is to say something that is the thing, but it was made in a way that is not normally sort of the natural way. So normally, insulin is made by your pancreas, but we have found a way to make insulin without going through your pancreas. And so it's really insulin, but it's not created in the natural way. Similarly, my car only takes synthetic oil, and that oil is, it works just like a regular oil that comes from fossils in the ground. So it's oil, but it was created artificially. And then we can even now, not we, but science now, can take animal fibers, muscle fibers, and grow artificial meat. So we can have something that's really a steak, really a hamburger, but it didn't come out of a muscle of a cow. It came out of something grown from a muscle of a cow. And if that's the case, then AI would be considered a new species because it's actually something that looks and smells and acts like a human. Maybe it doesn't smell like a human, but it looks and acts like a human and is really has those human properties. So what does that mean spiritually or philosophically? Well, there's a philosopher, he's now in his 90s, named John Searle, who talked about this concept back in the 1980s or so. One of the things he mentioned was, you know, we wouldn't be able to tell if this thing that's putting out 10 horsepower is really a gas engine or maybe it's an electric engine, but we wouldn't say that that also tells us, okay, if it's 10 horsepower, it must be an internal combustion engine. So it doesn't tell us anything about how that was generated. In fact, it could be a guy in a green shirt on a, you know, bicycle creating that 10 horsepower of power. So the fact that you have the external manifestation of power or language doesn't really tell you what's happening to create that language. Here's how Searle illustrated something called the Chinese room argument. So there's a guy in a room, can't be seen by the people outside the room, and people are sending him Chinese questions and words and characters and sentences, and he's looking up in this rule book what to do every time you see this symbol, you then respond with this symbol. So he's using a rule book to decide what to respond to in terms of the Chinese language, and if he's good enough, then the people on the outside will go, oh, whoever or whatever is in that room is an intelligent Chinese speaker. And all he's doing is putting characters together. This is what AI models do, okay? They do much more sophisticated than just the next, you know, word or token, but it is a program that is executing a logic to respond in such a way that it appears to be intelligent. But in this case, and so here's how John Searle said, the man in the Chinese room does not understand Chinese. He's merely manipulating symbols according to a rule book. He's instantiating a formal program, think computer program, which passes the Turing test for intelligence, but nevertheless, he does not understand Chinese. So this shows that the instantiation of a formal program, writing and running a computer program, for example, is not enough to produce what he calls semantic understanding or intelligence. Intentionality. In other words, just because something can interact with us with language, it is still a computer program, and therefore it doesn't have any more than this guy speaks Chinese. It doesn't have intention or consciousness, even if it tells you it does. It's just not logically possible. So this is the position of John Searle. It's a reaction against the what's called behaviorism, which says, well, if something is talking to me, then it must be like me, and so it must also have intention. There are other schools of thought, but at least if you read John Searle, you say, well, you know, question answered, this is not possible. Other people may say something different. Okay, so that was sort of as background. As you probably already know, there are AI models in almost all of the technologies that we use, from navigating as we did from the airport to translation on your watch. I use my phone to translate signs from other languages that I don't understand. Your phone will do AI inside the phone, looking for faces and drawing squares around them. your social media feed and the things that sites like Walmart or Amazon advertise to you are based on your past experiences or past movements and decisions, and those are called recommender systems. And then, of course, if you have one of these digital devices in your house for talking to people or asking for recipes or sports scores, that is a device that's also running artificial intelligence. So they're all around us. And what's happened in the last year or so is that companies like Apple and Microsoft and ChatGPT or OpenAI have been embedding the AI capabilities into their systems that you're used to using. So the middle one, for example, is I had a list of 1,400 people, and I could use this AI that's built in called Copilot to Microsoft Excel, and I could say, you know, tell me how many of these in the list came from Japan, or how many of them are named Charlie. And so I can begin to use the tools I normally use and then take advantage of AI. The one from Apple, if you're sending a text to somebody, like maybe you send a text to say, I'm really mad about this and you are not a good person, etc. Then you sort of hold off and say, please reword this into a friendly way to say it, and it will reword it for you. And some of us maybe need that tool more than others. So I also have been using ChatGPT on my phone to do lots of things. So in this case, like my kids, who are obviously, you know, 3 decades younger than I am, are always giving me a hard time about fashion. In fact, one of my kids says, Dad, do you buy all of your stuff at REI? And the answer, of course, is yes. But I said, is it okay to wear socks with my sandals? I don't have socks on now, but is it okay or is it too boomer? And so it came back and said, honestly, it's you know, it's cool. So you're ahead of your time. So even fashion advice from these is kind of fun. So I mentioned artificial neural networks. Now I want to dive a little bit into how these work, what we mean by machine learning. And this is not to overload you with a bunch of new terms you won't be quizzed afterward, but just to kind of give you a lay of the land. And I promise that you won't feel lost by any of the math unless you didn't take math in 7th or 8th grade, or unless you took it a long time ago, like some of us. So obviously, based on the concept of our neurons in our head, which have a bunch of inputs and then one or more outputs, and so we translate that into software programs that will mimic the individual neurons and the connections between them, so that the input to a number of different neurons will have an output that goes to a number of other neurons, and based on the those interactions, it will affect the behavior of the next neuron in the train. And we're now at the point, and I'll show you a graph of this later, but this complicated structure on the right is, believe it or not, a very simple AI chatbot, a simple architecture of a model like that. So there are lots of terms that we throw around. One is machine learning, another is deep learning. Sometimes we talk about natural language processing. And all of these are fields of AI that have grown up over the last 50 or 60 years. And it used to be that machine learning in the top, this is what the 3 Turing Award winners really specialized in, was just another branch of AI. And now it is the case that all branches of AI are using machine learning as their underlying toolbox. So what was at one point a sideline of AI is now the underlying mechanism for all of the breakthroughs that we're seeing in AI. The difference between machine learning and deep learning, we get to so from machine learning to deep learning to the networks that were models that we're using today with increasing capability along the way. With simple machine learning, the kind of thing that we were doing 15 years ago, you had to do a lot of work to prepare the data so that your model could understand that data. So you had to label things and you had to come up with different features you're interested in, and you had to do all sorts of prep. And then deep learning came along with, as it's kind of implied, deeper networks with more layers and more complexity in the network, where we could skip that that human input part, and it would figure out the classifications and other things. So whereas in the top, we could say, okay, well, here's 100 examples of cars. Here's 100 examples of not cars. And we would then take the images and do some munging around on their, you know, make them just right. And now with deep learning, we could just say, here's a bunch of images. Tell me what are the objects that you find in these images. And then from that, we can extract the cars or the not the cars. And what happened about 12 or 13 years ago, about 2012 is when we hit one point where things improved really dramatically. And that was in computer vision. And the graph in the upper right at the top is in about 2010, the best computer vision programs, if you said, is this a car or is this not a car, would get about 30%, would get about 70% correct with a 30% error. And then by about 2012, you can kind of see that it was on this trajectory with the dotted line going over like this, and then it dropped, meaning the error rates are going way faster down to zero. That was the introduction of using deep learning networks to learn and to do object recognition in computer vision. So that's when machine learning sort of took over computer vision, and very quickly the error rates got down to 5%, which is about the way humans are. And then in 2019, there was a company Google started called DeepMind in the UK, and they wrote a program that would take the specifications for a protein, which are these millions of letters that describe the protein, and then figure out from that, how does that protein fold up on itself to become its final shape, where those letters will determine a bend or not a bend or proximity or not. And that to in 2019, that took months of laboratory experimentation to figure out one protein, how it would fold. And you want to know this because proteins interact with other things based on their shape. And AlphaFold could do it in just a few minutes. So you could see the acceleration that AI, in this case, that AI brought to the world of bioinformatics, going from several months and probably $1 million to several minutes and not $1 million. So this goes back then to about 2012 when machine learning kind of took over the whole landscape. So what do we mean by a computer that learns? So this is the only math you're going to get. So you remember from grade school that if I want to describe a line like this red one here, I have a formula, y, which is the vertical, equals ax plus b. And a is the slope of that line, and b is how far up or down it is on the graph. And so if I want a computer to learn the best line that describes all of these dots, because in the y here is the number of dollars for a house, and the x is the square feet of that house. Sorry, I didn't Europeanize this. But so price versus floor space. And so I want to know, well, what's the formula for price given a certain floor space? In other words, what is y if I know x? If it's a 2,000 square foot house, what should I expect to pay for it based on all the data that we've collected from house sales? And to do that, I need to have a prediction, which is this formula over on the right-hand side. So I start out with some value, and I draw that line, I, in this case, being a computer program. So a computer program starts out with some values for A and B, and then calculates a score by looking at the distance between every point and that line, and sort of doing some good statistical math across there to decide how far is that line from the optimal point, where the optimal line is going to have the lowest error rate. This is being closest to all of the other dots. And so that one's not right, so it will adjust A and B, and it'll try again. And it'll keep trying this until it gets to the point where it's got the best solution, or maybe it'll try it 10 times, depends on how you implement it. But in this case, we say that the machine or the program learned the formula for house price versus floor space. So you can see this is just a way that that computers can learn. Now, in real life, and when you get to real machine learning applications, it's not just A equals XY plus B, or there are many things besides floor space. So if I just look on Zillow, for example, I can put in a bunch of filters where I can say, I only care about houses with 4 bedrooms and, you know, 16 bathrooms and a 7-car garage, right? Or I only care about houses that are less than 10 years old. So all of those are attributes of houses that go into the house price. So now we have something more complicated in our try to predict house price from characteristics. And we can do this with mathematics as well. It's just a little bit different mathematics and maybe more sophisticated. So I can then end up with, instead of y equals ax plus b, I have y equals something plus something times x plus something times, something times the number of bedrooms, something times the number of bathrooms. So I have this more complicated formula, but at the heart of it, it's the same as a equals xy plus b in principle. And so I translate that into some neural network, and then this is the part you want to remember. So we talk about parameters or weights, and I'll use that term as we go on. Those are how much weight we put on each of the inputs from each of those. So these are labeled here. So when I build a neural network, I have the neurons, and then I have the connections, and each of those connections has a weight. So we can measure or metric the size of the model by the number of weights. And then, I'll be using the term parameters for that. So how do we teach a neural network to see? So with the mathematics kind of tucked underneath this, how would I train a neural network to be able to tell, say, handwriting recognition, is this a 9 or is it a 4? And of course, the question is whether a European wrote it or an American wrote it. Is this a 1 or is this a 7? So I take my model and I start with some what we call training data. So I've got a 4, a 2, a 9, a 6, and a 4. And then I label them so I know what they are. And I first ask the model to take a guess. So it sends it through and the model guesses 9, 5, 6, 4, 6, 1. Well, I compare that and I go, oh, well, the model only got 1 correct. And so I go back into the model and I adjust all of those weights. And then I try again. And I do this millions of times. And so that is how we're training these neural networks, with sending data through and then adjusting the network and going through. So here's maybe a way to sort of look at the way this kind of looks, if you will. So this is a network for, and I'm going to try to see if I can pause. I might not be able to pause it. So this is a network that you can see the characters on the front of it, and those characters are being sent back through 1, 2, 3 layers of the network. And as it adjusts all those weights, it takes at the end, it tells us as it's jumping around there, the highest probability number from the one that was written and then going through the network there. So this network that just does this, and you can kind of only see this because I think only 2% of the lines are there. Otherwise, it would just look like a block, because it has 28 million of those parameters, 28 million lines. By contrast, you know, we have about 1 trillion parameters in our brains. Network here that I mentioned was a simple one. This only has 86,000 connections or parameters, which is considerably more than a fruit fly, which only has 500,000. And yet, a fruit fly does a really good job of what its train or what its network is designed to do, which is things like avoid fly swatters and find food. And so it's actually pretty impressive. So when we talk about scale, this is the 86,000 parameter network. And just to kind of put that in perspective, we'll go back to our Apple Watch. So just as these neural networks are built up on those little neurons, all of the computers that we use are also built on, not on neurons, but on transistors. It's a very simple technology, but if you put 6 billion of them together in just the right way, you get an Apple Watch. And so there's, if you look at that figure right there of the Apple Watch, that kind of schematic, if you all use your pointer. So this sort of schematic of the Apple Watch, you can already see visually that there are different parts of the surface that are doing different things. There's a cellular modem there, there's a processor there, there's some memory, there's a GPS on there. And so if, and this is like 6 billion. So here's 86,000. The initial ChatGPT was this model that if I take this and shrink it down to the same scale, is this over here, which was 1.5 billion parameters. So a huge set of complexity, but just like the Apple Watch, it's not arbitrary. It's designed with, you can kind of see that it's using the same part over and over again, just as the Apple Watch would, you know, in memory. If you have a gigabyte of memory, it's not a billion different things. It's a billion memory cells. So this is how we build complex things out of simple things. So 1.5 billion is very small by today's standards. The ChatGPT that you're using now is, they haven't disclosed the exact size, but it's somewhere between 1 and 2 trillion parameters. So another 1,000 times the size of this one here. So how do we train these models? So this is Andre Karpathy, who's one of the founders of OpenAI. He's not there anymore, but I liked his explanation of how we train these models as it relates to things that we're more familiar with. So if you think of a textbook, as you're reading the textbook, that's the pre-training state. And then we get to this point where we do some fine-tuning after the pre-training is done. And that's like try the problems where the solutions are right there. So you can look at the solution and figure out how to do the problem, but you've got the solution right there. And then there's something called reinforcement learning that comes later. And among other things, what that does is that's equivalent to trying the problems in the back of the book or the back of the chapter where the answer is not provided to you. And so you have to keep trying until you get to get the right answer. And the way this looks graphically is we have all this information from the World Wide Web and from collections of books and other things. And those go into pre-training something. And we get something called a pre-trained model. So GPT is generative pre-trained model. So that's where the GPT comes from, pre-trained. And then we go through this fine-tuning. So the training part costs months and millions of dollars to do. And I'll talk later about how much money is being invested now in that, the brute force computing that you need for that to get bigger and bigger models. The fine-tuning is more like hours of work and a few thousand dollars worth of computing time. And that's where conversations and question and answer sessions and other different data than here are pushed through. And then you have then a chatbot that you then do reinforcement learning. So reinforcement learning, among other things, is getting humans to interact with the model and say whether this is a good or a bad answer. You might have read recently that OpenAI released a new version of GPT-4, their latest, one of their latest models. And they had overtrained it in terms of being agreeable to the user. And so there were these stories of these ChatGPT experiences with this new version of the model where it was downright sycophantic. It was like almost worshiping the user and saying, agreeing with the user even when the model knew that the user was wrong, right? And so OpenAI reversed that, but that's where, even though nothing changed on the back end here, that reinforcement learning is where the models kind of get, I'll say, get their personality. And we could also do reinforcement learning to, that's how we get models to not swear at you, to not, look up people's email addresses. I just tried that the other day and found out I can't do it. So I got to go back to Google because I was trying to find somebody's email address. It's where it will prevent, that reinforcement learning will do things like prevent the model from telling you how to make a nuclear bomb or any kind of bomb. So that becomes this personality portion there. And then the way this works is you take this data, like these books, and you break it into small chunks, and here we'll just, for illustration purposes, would you tell me, please, which way I ought to go from here is the sentence. But we mask out a few of the words and try to get the language model to guess the word that goes there. So just like you do with your kids with these ad libs things. And sometimes it's as funny as the ad lib coming out of the model. But you can then score those and then run this through the model again. So that's the, basically word guessing part. That's how it's trained to do word guessing. And then the fine tuning is something similar where we take maybe not a huge corpus of books, but a small labeled data set that I might have in my laboratory, or a textbook that wasn't used as part of the original training, and we can go through that. There's a site called Hugging Face on the internet. Last year when I gave this talk, they had 600,000 models that you could download, because I can download a model, I can then fine-tune it for maybe something I'm interested in, and then I can put it back in Hugging Face and other people can use it. And now there are 1.5 million models. There were a million models back in December. So this is the sharing site where millions of people are taking models in and then providing them to other people. So anybody that wants to build these kind of models now can do it. It doesn't require a big company or you know, lots and lots of money. And why that's important. So these models are all pre-trained. And remember, the pre-training part is the most expensive part. So, and it's the part that's the least customized. So all of these models are pre-trained, which means that people can take the advantage of, say, Meta. They've been publishing their series of models called the Llama series of models. They've done the heavy lifting of pre-training those models, and then you can take them and customize them for your own use, spending thousands of dollars or maybe hundreds of dollars rather than millions of dollars, which most of us don't have. So I don't want to overstate the simplicity and say these are just token predictors, because they actually can appear to be, or they can reason, even though they don't have a consciousness or a will. But they are, in the end of the day, they are token predictors. And the way they do that and how they do it afterward and how many tokens they predict may differ. But it's just taking, if I say, please write me a limerick about Christian professors, I'm from the Scientist Network, gathering in Poland. And so it's going to take that prompt. It's going to go, what's the most logical next word to that? Well, first, it's going to take it and translate it out of English and into tokens that each have. So the word please is token number 5718. The word right is 3350. And sometimes the token is just a partial word. Sometimes it's an entire word. Sometimes it's two words. And so it gets tokenized, and now what the model is not seeing, please write me a limerick, it's just seeing this sequence of numbers. And so it's saying, okay, well, based on everything that I read in my pre-training, what's the most probable next number in that series? So maybe the next number would be certainly. You know, and of course, it could be something different. Models, as you go through, will give you different answers, and you can adjust that predictability by something called temperature. But it's going to do that over. And then for the second word, it's going to include the word certainly, and then it's going to do that again. And this window is called the context window, if you've heard that term. And today's models can have context windows that are millions of characters. So you can have, as part of your prompt, I've done this just recently, I've taken an entire user manual for a particular computer. And I said, I don't have time to read this, so I gave it to a model. And I said, just tell me how to write the code to do this on this computer. And a few seconds later, it had digested that model and given me some computer code that I could try, because its context window was much larger than this short one here. So this is just token prediction. Now what we're seeing is models going beyond just token predicting, but also using external tools. So one such tool is, you might have noticed, depending on the models that you use, that now you can ask a question. It used to be, like when ChatGPT came out, I said, who won the Super Bowl last year? Just to kind of quiz it. And it didn't know, because its training data stopped at a certain date. They finished the pre-training, and anything that happened after that, the model didn't know about. But now the models can, you'll notice that they'll say, searching the web. It'll go out and search the web for information. So now I can be more specific. I could say, well, write me a limerick about Christian professors gathering in Poland, and include references and speaker names from the 2024 ELF. And so you get the sort of same thing. I'm going to skip through. It's going to go out and look for information on the web, and that's going to include that web data as part of its token predictor context. So it's going to add the web data each time. And it's going to come up with one that in Wisla, professors convened with Wisdom and Insights Esteem. John Dixon took stage. Bruel engaged at ELF, their spirits redeemed. So it now can put specific things in because it went out and used the web. There are lots of these tools that models are using now. Another one is coding or writing software. And there are times when you just you want it to solve a math problem, but you want to make sure it's correct. And since it's a language model, token prediction isn't the best way to do math. And so you might say, but write me a program to do this. So this time use code. And so it'll write this program and it'll run it for you. And in some cases, if it's got an error, it will run it again and fix it. These kind of tools make the models much more powerful. Another way that models are getting more powerful, and you see this as well depending on the model that you're using, and sometimes it's annoying. If I'm using the most advanced model from OpenAI, that's O3 is the name for it, I might forget that I'm talking to it instead of the simpler model and ask it a simple question. And it's annoying because it goes through this iteration of, well, you can see it printing. It said, well, the user is asking for this. Maybe I'll search this, or maybe I'll do this. And then it'll do that four or five times before it decides who won the Super Bowl last year, whatever my question was. And what's happening there is the model, oops, I don't know what happened there. Let's see what happened. Is the model is generating lots of possible solutions, and then it's using another model to see which ones are correct or most likely correct, and then it's choosing the best one, and then it's going to go on from there. So models are, some people call this the tournament. They're putting themselves through a tournament to a contest to see who can give the best answer back to the user. And then over time, the models get better and better at this reasoning or thinking. And again, we're using human words like thinking or reasoning, but when I say that, I'm really talking about a mathematical algorithm that's doing something like these tournaments. So a couple things I thought were kind of fun. So one, I was just watching this, Karpathy has this 3-hour video on how all this stuff works that I thought was fun enough to watch. I didn't watch for 3 hours because I put him on 2x speed, but for an hour and a half, I watched it. He came to this point where he said, he asked the model, which is bigger, 9.11 or 9.9? And the model says 9.11 is bigger than 9.9. So what was going on there? And then this other group wrote a paper about this, and they found that the Bible, because 9:11 is larger after than 9:9, right? You know, Romans 9:9 is smaller than Romans 9:11. And so they actually were able to find the specific neurons in the neural network that had encoded this incorrect reasoning. It's not, I mean, just incorrect. And so they were able to remove those neurons and then, you know, get the model to improve. But I just thought it was interesting, like, you know, God's word is affecting even the internals of these models. Another food for thought I thought was kind of fun. So I talked about our computer, the Aurora GPT. It's actually 16 rows like that one there. And each of those red and blue hoses are going into a board that's got 16 processors in it. And it has 868 neurons, if you will. Those are the CPUs, the processors. And 1 trillion parameters are syntax. So we can build a model that's easily 1 trillion. That machine cost, well, humans are way more valuable, so that machine was expensive. The fruit fly has 550,000 synapses and 3,000 neurons. And again, as I mentioned before, you know, an amazing feat of engineering for God to design a fruit fly with a brain that small that's able to do the things it can do. And we humans are 86 billion neurons and 1 million synapses. And this is an interesting thing. Over the last 10 years, we've been trying to add 3 zeros after the speed of our machine, something called the Exascale Computing Project that resulted in that machine and several like it, was to try to get a machine from this speed like we had 5 years ago and 1,000 times faster like this one. And the big part of that engineering was the power requirement and how do we do this on a small amount of power. And we didn't really solve that. And the next 1,000 is going to be even harder. And you'll see why in a moment. So the human brain, our brain, can operate on 20 watts. That's 3 electric toothbrushes. So 3 AA batteries, right? And we can do things that this computer can't do on the right. On the other hand, you might say, well, that computer probably uses as much energy as a football stadium, whether it's a European or American football stadium, right? Say 5 megawatts. And in fact, you'd be off by a factor of 12. That machine takes 60 megawatts. 60 megawatts is 12 stadiums or a town of about 100,000 people. So the energy bill is about $1 million a year. So this is an expensive business to get into. This is why if you're the normal person or a small company, you just can't afford to pre-train your own models because it takes this kind of investment to do. And the next machine after that, we and several other places are looking at the need for a gigawatt, which is 1,000 megawatts, at which point you, in some cases, would have to build a new nuclear plant. Fortunately, in Illinois, we have nuclear power, and so we have that capacity. But it's an expensive thing, and I just thought it was pretty amazing that this thing on the right, which is very clunky compared to this thing up here, needs to use so much energy when God designed our brains to use very little energy. And like the DeLorean in the Back to the Future, where he comes back and he's like throwing eggshells and banana peels in for fuel, we're the same way. We can actually survive on maybe not eggshells and banana peels, but eggs and bananas we could do. So that's kind of the foundation.